Good day, and welcome to the Cigna Autism Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'll turn the conference over to Christy Folly. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Audra. Welcome, and thank you for calling into Cigna's Autism Awareness Series. My name is Christy Folly, and I am a care manager for the autism team at Cigna. Due to the format of this call, you will not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of this conference, you will be transferred into a brief 5-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After this survey, you will be able to ask questions on today's presentation. A handout for today's seminar is available online at www.cigna.com/autism. Scroll to Current Topics section in the middle of your page and click on today's topic labeled Challenging Behaviors. Please note that not all policies cover today's topic. For more specific information, if your policy covers topics discussed in today's seminar, please contact the autism team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Today I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Melissa Olive. Dr. Olive has her PhD and is a board-certified behavior analyst. She is the owner of Applied Behavioral Strategies in Connecticut, which offers individual program analysis and development. The practice has over 30 years combined experience in working with individuals with behavioral challenges. Dr. Olive, thank you for being here today, and you are welcome to start your presentation.
Thank you, and I just cannot say enough about Cigna taking the initiative to offer these trainings for families and teachers and other interested parties. It is such a needed thing, and we really appreciate the ability to be able to share information through you guys. In addition to the handouts being on Cigna's website, my web team will also put them on my homepage, which is www.appliedbehavioralstrategies.com. But please give them a day or so to get those loaded. We also have a few other social media things that you might find as a resource. From our website, you can jump over to the blog where we do write about problem behavior and other aspects of having a loved one with autism or a child in your classroom with autism. And then we also have a mailing list that we keep, so you're welcome to join our mailing list as well. So as you know, we're here today to talk about challenging behavior. And you know, we can talk about what behavior looks like, but I think the biggest thing to focus on is how the behavior affects everyone. And so we define challenging behavior as any behavior that affects the child's learning, that affects the learning of others, that hurts himself or hurts others, and that may even serve to socially isolate the person. And I have to disclose, I have a loved one with autism as well. He is 35 years old. He also carries a diagnosis of mental retardation or intellectual disability. He moved in with me when he was 13, and I am his guardian even today. He also resides in Connecticut, and he has a lifelong history of challenging behavior. So I certainly not only have the academic skills to talk about it, but I can talk firsthand about how it does interfere with everyday activities. The take-home point, if you take nothing else with you today, it is so important to understand that challenging behavior is communication 99% of the time. And, you know, sometimes the behavior will keep families from going out to restaurants or from going to Target or from going to get the groceries, to get groceries. And I have to remind you that as stressful as it is, it's really important to work on the behaviors and help your loved one get out into those situations. If you look around, you will see toddlers engaging in many of the same behaviors that individuals with autism engage in, and it's completely socially acceptable. And the reason why it's socially acceptable is because everyone recognizes that they're toddlers, and toddlers engage in problem behavior because they also lack the communication skills. And you may be thinking, oh, but my child or my student speaks and talks and is fine. But even for those individuals, the behavior still can serve a communication purpose. So we're going to talk today about how to find out what purpose the behavior is serving for the child, and then how to go about addressing it. We also think about the paradigm of a behavior deficit or a behavior excess. And again, 9 times out of 10, the learner has a behavior deficit. And so it might be communication, but it might also be a self-help skill, like learning how to tie their shoes or learning how to get dressed. My brother gets very, very anxious around mealtime. And so if he's hungry and he says he wants to eat and you say, okay, I'll go make you a sandwich, he immediately begins to start screaming because he wants his sandwich now. And so we have to teach him, you know, two things. He has this behavior excess, which is too much screaming, but he also has the skill deficit, which is waiting. And so many of the children that I know have a difficult time waiting. So we go in and we look at why problem behavior occurs. And behavior, all of your behavior, my behavior, your husband's behavior, your wife's behavior, all of our behaviors happen for a reason. And they happen because the environment supports the behavior. So my brother, for example, you're probably thinking, well, he's going to get fat when he screams because it's lunchtime and it's time to eat. And so he has inadvertently learned, I scream, I get fed. What he doesn't know is that the person's not feeding him because he was screaming. The person was feeding him because it was lunchtime. And so he's got to learn to separate that the meal doesn't immediately follow the behavior. So for his behavior, he screams, and the consequence is he gets fed. For me, I like to tie my behaviors to the behavior of other people in places like Starbucks. Why do I go to Starbucks? Because I get my drink exactly the way I like it, with soy milk, with sugar-free ingredients, without caffeine. And I keep going back to Starbucks because I know that they're always going to have what I want. So Starbucks reinforces my behavior. Now, sometimes our bad behavior gets reinforced as well. So I gave you the example of my brother's bad behavior getting reinforced. But sometimes, and you may find this shocking, my own bad behavior gets reinforced. And so I'll give you an example. If I have a difficult day, whether I'm traveling to go help a child in another state, or if I had difficulty in traffic, my mood is affected, as I'm sure yours is as well. And so when you get grumpy, you're much more likely to engage in behaviors. And so the grumpiness might set off a tantrum on my part. And so if I go to check into my hotel and they don't have my reservation and I begin to engage in an adult tantrum, which I'm sure you've all done at some point in your life, the hotel then will reinforce my bad behavior by finding me a room or getting me an accommodation if the accommodation was lost. So the same thing happens for our learners. They are reinforced for their bad behavior, whether intentional or accidental. Now, all the examples I've given so far are about when individuals get things that they want. Okay, we call that positive reinforcement because the plus in if you're studying atoms in physics, the plus has a positive valence, and so we put plus with positive. So plus in math means add. So you're getting something, you're adding something. There's also negative reinforcement, and I don't want to bog you down with terminology, but negative reinforcement people think is bad because of the word negative, but actually it's good in the eyes of the person, right? So the negative piece, so we'll go back to our physics, the negative, when you break apart an atom, you get the negative charge for the electron. And so the minus sign means take away, and in physics the minus sign means negative. And so we put those things together. When something is taken away or when something is removed, then the behavior is reinforced. So let me give you a couple of examples so that makes sense. Some of my students that I teach at the University of St. Joseph here in Connecticut, sometimes they go out and they engage in having cocktails. And they might have too many cocktails, and then what happens is they get a headache. So their behavior of having a headache is usually followed by and aspirin. And why do they take aspirin? Well, it makes their headache go away. So in this instance, the behavior of taking the aspirin is reinforced by the removal of the pain. If you think about your students with autism who maybe don't like loud spaces like the cafeteria, they may engage in hand flapping or ear covering to signify this room is too loud. And so sometimes staff will help them leave the cafeteria or leave the assembly or leave the noisy area, and the student's behavior is reinforced by getting away. We can take that to the classroom and look at circle time or calendar time or any time when the teacher's talking. And if the student is bored or if the student is confused because the language is over their head or if, in fact, they just don't like math, then the students might engage in problem behavior. And teachers do not like to have their lessons interrupted. And so if the student is engaging in bad behavior while the teacher is talking, that student is probably going to get sent away from the lesson. They might have to go to timeout. They might have to go to the back of the room. They might have to go sit out in the hall. They might even get sent to the principal's office. And in all of those situations, while it doesn't seem like it's reinforcing, the student is getting what they want, which is out of math or out of circle time. And so it's that removal of the thing the student doesn't like that makes them continue to engage in the behavior. So positive and negative reinforcement are good things in the student's eyes because they're getting their way. They're either getting something they want or they're avoiding or getting out of something that they don't want. And so thanks to a lot of other researchers out there, we came to learn they started looking at it in the early 80s, and then we really wrapped our heads around it in the late 80s and the early 90s. And then in the early 90s, it became part of special education law, this whole term called function. And so you've probably heard the term functional behavior assessment. So a BCBA or someone who's trained similar to a BCBA learns how to do what's called a functional behavior assessment. And so when I trained special education teachers, I trained them how to do a functional behavior assessment to understand why is the child engaging in the behavior. Are they trying to get something or are they trying to get out of something? And so we call that the function, all right? And historically, so long before the 80s, back when my brother was still a toddler, we had planned interventions that we did for behaviors, and we did them the same way. So when my brother spit, and I know this is going to scare you, we were taught way back then to squirt water in his face to make him stop spitting. Well, now that I'm all educated and know these things, I've learned he was spitting for attention. And so when we went to squirt water in his face, because that's what the psychologist told us to do, we were giving him the attention that he really wanted. He also pulls hair for attention, and he screams for attention. And so he has learned how to do all of these behaviors, all to get the attention that he so desperately wants. And so what we have to do is back up and teach him that skill deficit, how to ask for attention the right way. And now you're probably thinking, you said he's nonverbal, so how are you going to teach him to ask? And that's a topic that we're going to talk about in a couple of weeks when we talk about augmentative communication for nonverbal students. So back to our functions. If you have the handouts downloaded, it is slide 9. And in that slide, there's a top panel and a bottom panel. And so we talk about positive reinforcement with that plus sign, and we talk about negative reinforcement with that negative sign, keeping in mind that both things are things that the student likes. And in both situations, the things they like can be similar or different, and they're always different for every child. So we might have one child that really, really, really likes to get an object, like, let's say, a green bean, for example. But we might have another child with autism who hates green beans. And so if he's offered green beans, he will spit and throw and kick and bite. We also, that's what I call getting an object or escaping an object. We also have obtaining an activity. and escaping an activity. So you can obtain computer time, for example. One child might love computer time, and another child might hate it. And so, again, the function of, for their behavior is going to be different based on their preferences. We also have attention, which I talked a little bit about. My brother loves to get attention, but we have children who do not want attention. And so they might spit on you to make you walk away from them, or they might hit you to make you walk away from them, or they might bite you. And those are all very effective ways to make people go away. Now, if you see the slide, you will see that there is a slightly different color for the word sensory, because sensory is another consequence that students may try to get or try to escape. And we talked about the lunchroom and the assemblies being way too loud. Well, those are examples of sensories that the students will try to escape. But what are the sensories that students try to get? Well, this is reserved strictly for those few instances where we hand slap, where we rock, where we bite our hands, sometimes where we slap our head. Most of the time, those behaviors are sensory-seeking behaviors. Now, my brother, because he's 35 and he's been doing this a really long time, he has learned to take those sensory behaviors and use them to get his way in other areas. So rocking, he's a very big rocker. And he rocks, I think, because he likes to watch how the stimuli go past his eyes. But he's also learned to rock to get out of something that he doesn't like. He does not like to, for people to be close to him. And so he will often move his body to move away from people who get too close. But he's also learned if he pulls hair, that will make the people scoot away as well. So my brother's one of those very complicated individuals who use a lot of different behaviors to get a lot of different things. And that's why that assessment piece is so important. There is no one answer for every child. And so the properly trained professional will come in and do those assessments for you. Now, if your student is under the age of 21, then the school district can help you with that assessment. And like Christy said, you may or may not have the insurance benefit to help with that, but the school district is required by law to assist in determining why the behaviors are problematic. If the student is over 21, then you might have to go through your state disability provider to get that assistance, and that might come from, in Connecticut, it's called the Department of Developmental Services. In Texas, I think it was called the Department of Aging and Disability Services. And so you'll have to know your own state and what your state offers and if that benefit is even available. But there are trained professionals out there who can help you understand why the behavior is happening. Now, the other thing that is really important is understanding sometimes events set off behaviors. So hunger, sleep deprivation, feeling scared about a situation, transitions, those are all things that can set off behaviors in our students, and those are things that have to be attended to as part of the assessment process. And I just, the only other thing I want to say about the assessment process is, how do you know if you're getting a good one? The general answer can be found on page 11. A good assessment is going to include interviews with the person that knows the student the best, so the parents and the teachers, sometimes the siblings. Then you're going to also see direct observation. So they need to see, the assessor needs to see the student where the behaviors happen. So if they happen at school, they need to observe at school. If they happen at home, they need to observe at home. You have to be able to see the behavior to know why the behavior is happening. Now, a functional analysis is a part of the functional assessment, and it's not always required. And so you want to, keep in mind that if the functional analysis is not there, that doesn't mean it's a bad assessment. But you also don't want to be alarmed if there is a functional analysis because it might be necessary for your student. And then after the assessment, the assessor will say, why is Johnny engaging in the behavior? And they will specifically say, he's trying to get attention. He's trying to get activities. He's trying to get tangibles, or he's trying to get sensory. or he's trying to escape activities, escape attention, escape tangible, and escape sensory. Those are the only eight outcomes of the assessment. Now, the assessor might also say, Johnny needs to learn to ask for help, Johnny needs to learn to ask for attention, and Johnny needs to learn how to wait. But those are skills that would be taught as part of the behavior intervention plan. Now, I put in a few slides about school requirements because, you know, if your student is having difficulty at school, it's really important to make sure that you recognize the students with disabilities cannot be suspended for their behaviors at school. Now, if they bring a drug or a weapon to school, the rules change ever so slightly, but most of us keep our kids safe from those things. But up to 10 days, so if a student is suspended for more than 10 days, then their rights under special education law are being violated. We also, if a student is in a classroom and they're having difficulty with behavior, we can't take them out of that classroom and move them to a more restrictive place because of their behavior. So if you have a student in kindergarten and they're engaging in behavior and the kindergarten teacher doesn't like it, she can't say, I'm sending Johnny to special education because his behavior is so bad. What happens, the school must first do the assessment and try to help Johnny stay in kindergarten with support. And then sometimes there are emergencies, and those emergencies are bringing a drug or bringing a weapon or serious imminent harm. You know, we had a student the other day who broke a window and it caused an injury to himself and to others, and so that was a pretty serious event. In those situations, they can do an emergency placement, but only for 10 days, at which point they have to figure out, you know, again, why the behavior is happening. Now, everybody, not just schools, everybody should be doing evidence-based treatment. And we know that one of the biggest evidence-based treatments for problem behavior or for challenging behavior is called positive behavior support. And I just realized my slide needs to be updated ever so slightly. It should say positive behavior intervention and supports. And the reason why they added the I in there, so it says PBIS, is because the television station, PBS, was getting an inordinate amount of phone calls from parents and teachers asking for help on PBS. And so they contacted the PBIS folks, and they asked them to change the name so that people could at least find the right supports from the right places. And so there's a great website called PBIS.org, and you can find a ton of information there as well. So what is PBIS? Well, it's good behavior intervention based on everything that we know about applied behavior analysis. The interventions are practical for parents to implement, practical for teachers to implement. The interventions are always based on that assessment that I told you about. The interventions teach our students independence. It teaches them adaptive skills, and so adaptive skills are brushing your teeth and feeding yourself and toileting and getting dressed, all of those things that are so important for the person to become independent. And these interventions also work on communication. And if you go back to the very first thing I said, if you don't remember anything else, remember that behavior is communication. And so any behavior plan that you're going to develop must include a communication part for the student. Now, it's also important to remember that PBIS is culturally sensitive. And so, you know, I am a Caucasian, and we're middle class, and what I want for my brother may not match what one of my clients wants for their students. So if I work with Jewish families, or if I work with Hispanic families, or if I work with Asian American families, they all have different goals for their kids. And so I work with them and their culture to make sure that the interventions match their family needs. What is PBS not? Well, PBS is not the same plan for every child. It's an individualized program based on their unique skills and needs of that student. It's also not a simple form that you fill out at a meeting. Okay, positive behavior interventions and support is a very lengthy process, and you might end with a document that's 2 pages long, maybe 3 pages if it's a very serious case, but it is a very simple plan for everyone to follow. It's not a form that where everyone looks the same. It is also not a document that gets stuffed into a filing cabinet. We can't put the document away and not implement the interventions therein. And finally, no behavior intervention plan should ever include a restraint. A restraint is an emergency technique, and I'm going to add the word seclusion too. And the seclusion where the individual is put into a closet and the door is locked, that should not be a part of the plan that's developed for your student. Now, I want to talk just a little bit about a belief system, and normally this is where I do some choral responding. So if you know the answer, say it, you know, to yourself. When a student doesn't know how to drive, what do? We teach him how to drive. When a child doesn't know how to wash her hands, what do? We teach her to wash her hands. When a person doesn't know how to read, what do? We teach her to read. But when a child doesn't know how to behave, what do? We punish. And so we want to move away from that mindset because we want to teach children how to behave. We don't want to punish them. I'm not saying you should never punish because there are situations that need to have consequence, but we want to start with teaching skills first. And so you're probably sitting there going, oh, my gosh, I came to this training because I wanted to learn what to do. And so on slide 17, I talk about what to do. First, you want to prevent behaviors from happening, right? That's the most important thing is prevention. The second most important thing is to recognize what sets off the behavior. So if we look at my brother, for example, if we're riding in the car, and we come to a red light, I know for a fact that sets off his behavior. And so now we have a behavior plan for him to have magazines and books in the car so that he has something to look at during the red light and traffic jams so that he doesn't get so upset. We also want to recognize behavior change. So sometimes our kids do a wind-up before they throw the curveball. And so it's important to recognize what are the wind-ups. For my brother, rocking almost always precedes when he bites his hand. And so if I can catch him at the rocking when he's mad, I can prevent him from going into that full-fledged hand bite. And then, of course, making sure that you have the assessment and a good behavior intervention plan. Now, that means that we have to teach the students to learn new skills that they may not have. We might have to teach them new strategies to use in certain situations. And we might have to teach them new behaviors to use when they are in difficult times. All of this instruction we call teaching in the antecedent condition. So teaching before the child has an opportunity to misbehave. And so there are 6 big strategies that I want you all to remember, and those strategies are all listed on slide 19. First, we're going to work on improving the student's communication, and we're going to go into detail about that in a second. We're going to work on improving the adult's communication. So that means yours, that means the teacher's, and that means any other adult in the person's life. So for my brother, that's his group home staff. We also need to increase reinforcement. We all need reinforcement. I get paid. You get paid. That's why we've had our job. We don't do our work for free. I will say, Cigna's not paying me for this call today. I'm doing it for free because it's important. But for the most part, we don't work unless we get paid. There are situations where we trick the children, and we'll talk about what those might look like. Sometimes we actually have to modify how we teach, and that's the school's responsibility, and that's the adult services' responsibility. And then finally, we have to be consistent in our consequences. So let's start with teaching the student to communicate. There are 2 big interventions that are going to be helpful. One is what we call overall communication intervention. Now, if your child has a school-based program or a home-based program, your child should be learning how to do what we call MAND training, M-A-N-D, MAND training. In MAND training, the students with autism learn to ask for things. They learn to ask for help. They learn to ask for more. They learn to ask to eat. They learn to ask to take a break. And those are all big pieces of a puzzle, right? If we give the kids the skills to talk, then they won't have to engage in problem behavior. So a comprehensive communication intervention program should be a part of any child with autism's regular program. That's absolutely 100% essential. And so you want to target really meaningful, useful language. And I call it, not to confuse it with the FBA functional, but I call it functional language, usable language, language that the child can make sense out of. And so on slide 21, I list a few skills, you know, so you can see the difference between a functional skill and a non-functional skill. Knowing all of the 50 states and their capitals, that's a non-functional skill. A functional skill is a skill that if the child with autism cannot do the skill, someone has to do it for them. And so if the child can't name the states and they can't name the 50 capitals, somebody does not have to do that for him. But if he can't ask for a drink, someone has to do it for him. If the child knows all of their colors, right, that's a skill, it's a great skill, it's an academic skill. But if they can't know their colors, or if they don't know their colors, no one has to do it for them. But if they can't ask, for what they're going to eat for lunch, then someone has to do it for them. If a child cannot count to 100 by tens, nobody has to do that skill for them. But if a child can't ask to take a break when they're tired or when they're having a difficult time, somebody has to do that for them. So we want to make sure that we're teaching them words that they can use every day of their life. The other intervention that I want to talk about is called functional communication training. So that's FCT. It's not to be confused with facilitated communication, which we will talk a little bit about when we talk about augmentative communication. All right, functional communication training is specifically taking a problem behavior and replacing it with good behavior. So when my brother screams in order to get fed, we're going to teach him not to scream, and instead we're going to teach him to go over, get his iPad, and hit the button that says, I want a sandwich. And there's many different things you can teach your children to do instead of their problem behavior. And, we can go on and on about how to do that communication intervention, but it's absolutely 100% critical that any child with autism have a good communication program, and if they're engaging in problem behavior, they need to learn communication replacement for that behavior. Now I'm going to move on to the adults need to communicate clearly. I know life is hard when you have a person with autism, and as a teacher, it's equally challenging. But we have to remember to slow down and communicate in a language these students understand. That includes using visual schedule. Now, I can't get through my day without my iPhone and my calendar. I would be lost if I lost my phone because it has my email, it has my calendar, it has everything on it. And that is my crutch, my visual support. Even as we sit here talking, I have my laptop in front of me and I have all the slides in front of me. Those are my visual support. I need those to be successful. There's nothing wrong with a student with autism also having those same visual support. Now, a student with autism might need different supports than me, but they still need them to be successful. There's quite a bit of research on the importance of those visual schedules as well. Just having a schedule in general is also a very important thing for students. So if your student or your child does not have a schedule that is clearly communicated to them, then that should be one of your goals to, you know, within the next 2 weeks, get a visual schedule so that your student knows what's my schedule at school, what's my schedule when I wake up in the morning, what's my schedule when I get off the bus, what's my schedule when I take a bath. All of those are important schedules that the student can learn if they have the visual support to help them. And I'm a firm believer in making sure that all activities are scheduled. my brother's going to the dentist today when we finish this call. And so he knows he's going to the dentist because it's on his schedule, and he can see it and he can check it. He also knows he's going to come back to my house after the dentist, and he doesn't have to go back to his group home until tomorrow because that's on his schedule. Another really good intervention that will help you communicate clearly is called the PREMAC principle. All of you use this intervention. I know you do because the research says you do. You might use it with your typical kids. You might even use it with your child with autism. It's called if, then. If you clean your plate, then you can have dessert. If you clean up your toys, then you can go outside. If you put your dirty clothes in the hamper, then you will get an allowance. It's a very simple intervention, and it works even better if you put some visuals with it. So I have an if-then board that I use with most of my students, and it just says simply, first work, then break with the computer, or first clean up, and then iPad time, or first eat your broccoli, and then you can have your chocolate. Now, the third intervention that I told you I wanted you to, we want to teach the child to communicate. We want to teach the adults to communicate. We also need to increase reinforcement. And again, there's lots of research on how to increase reinforcement. We can do that by contingently giving the reinforcer, oh, look at you, you cleaned up your room. Immediately, you get your allowance. But it might also be non-contingently, where you say, oh, man, you have had such a great week at school. It sounds like your teachers have been happy with you all week. We're going to go to the movie on Friday and have popcorn and soda. We might also do a very specific intervention where we differentially reinforce. So we give you bigger and better reinforcers when you do your work by yourself. And if you do your work with help, you get a little bit of a reinforcer. So we're trying to teach the students more and more independence is better than having assistance. Now, I did talk about tricking children, and when I say trick them, that's not really an intervention, but it will help you remember some interventions that you can use. Choice making is one of the best trick interventions that you can do. If your student has a hard time picking out, or if your student gives you pushback about what to wear when you're getting dressed in the morning, instead of saying, here, put this shirt on, instead, hold up two shirts and say, which shirt do you want to wear today? There have been a number of studies that have shown that merely giving the student the choice will keep them from engaging in problem behavior and will help them engage in the right behavior. So try to think about all the times across the day that instead of bossing the children or telling them what to do, instead, doing it is not a choice. How you do it can be a choice. So for teachers, if you're trying to get your children from your homeroom down to the music class, you could say, how are we going to walk down the hall today? Are we going to walk with a marshmallow in our mouth? Or are we going to walk with clam claps as we're walking down? So the students can have a little fun with it, but they're also choosing how they are quiet as they move through the school. At home, you can give choices about what vegetable you're going to eat. So instead of saying, here, we're having green peas today, you can say, dude, do you want green peas or do you want Brussels sprouts? Both are green. Both are usually non-preferred, but now they have a choice over the lesser of the two evils. And by the way, I love them both. We can do this easy intervention called preferred item as a distractor. Now, I do this almost all the time. I listen to music when I'm doing a not-so-preferred thing. So if I'm cleaning the house, I have my fun music on in the background. Or if I am doing the dishes, I have my fun music on in the background. Sometimes I eat chocolate when I'm having to sit through a terrible IEP meeting or when I'm having to sit through a boring lecture. I hope maybe you guys are having chocolate right now. Another intervention is called high probability request sequences, HPR. And one of the thesis students at USJ actually presented a cool study that she did in her classroom. She's the teacher, and she did HPR with her students in circle time. And HPR is simply asking the student to do things that they can do quickly and easily, and you do it 2, to 5 times right before you ask them to do something they don't like to do. So, for example, you might say, touch your nose, clap your hand, pat your head, find your seat. And the student gets a reinforcer, you know, they get high five, and so they tap their head, yay, they clap their hands, yay, they touch their nose, yay, they find their seat, yay. They're literally tricked into doing it. And again, I'm only giving you evidence-based interventions. This intervention has been studied multiple times and has been shown to be incredibly effective. And then the last trick intervention I'm going to teach you is called embedding. And that's where you do a fun thing and then a not so fun thing and then a fun thing and then a not so fun thing, which you can put right into your schedule that you're going to make with your visual pictures. So yes, my brother has to go to the dentist today. If he's good as a dentist, he will get a fun thing after. So it balances the bad with the good. And again, visualizing it and knowing that it's coming is very helpful. You don't ever want to do 2 bad things right in a row. And I don't know if you've noticed in schools rarely have reading and math back to back. They will have reading followed by recess, then math. Or they'll have reading followed by music and then math. So there's a reason why we mix things up. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the 5th intervention because that's modifying instruction. But you can always refer back to the slides and just recognize that we do need to modify instruction for some kids in order for them to be successful. So it might be that we modify the level of difficulty. We might decrease the workload. And we might embed reinforcers in the middle of it. And so sometimes what I have done, if a student's working on a math worksheet, I will, instead of having them do the whole sheet, I'll cross off the last 2 rows of problems so that they only have to do the first 2 rows of problems. And they're pretty excited about that. So they'll quickly do that, those problems and be done. Or I might take a Hershey's Kiss or something similar with parent permission and put it halfway through and say, oh, if you can get to this Hershey's Kiss, then you can open it and have it as a special treat. And that's what we call embedding the reinforcer. Now, one of the quotes, and I wish I knew who to attribute the quote to, the greatest thing about working with challenging behavior is that if you mess up, you will get to try again. And, you know, I can, all of those interventions that I showed you, so teaching the student to communicate, you communicating better, it modifying the instruction and tricking them, all of those things are effective. But if you forget to do one of those things and the behavior, you know, happens, then you should have a plan in place about how to respond. So I'm going to give you a few things. What should you not do? Well, do not overreact. Do not shout. Do not argue. Do not tug or grab. Do not get in the student's face. Do not nag. Do not preach. Do not corner the student. And do not make threats that you can't carry out. And I know that sounds like a lot of me bossing you, but we know that all those things are ineffective at helping behavior. We also know that if you're doing them when the student is mad, then you're less likely to get a good response. Think about when you're mad. How do you want your husband or your wife or your boyfriend to respond? Do you want them to get in your face? Do you want them to nag at you about how bad your tantrum is? Do you want them to threaten you with a consequence? All of those things are just going to make you madder. And so my golden rule for working with problem behavior is do unto others. Treat individuals the way you want to be treated. And if you remember that, it will really help in the long run. The most powerful intervention that you can do, as long as you're also doing intervention, as long as you're also doing reinforcement, is what we call extinction. And I know that sounds like something evil that we do to animals when we pollute the environment or misuse them. Extinction in the behavioral science is not giving the person what they want. It's very simple. If your child is in Target and they're laying on the floor having a tantrum because they want you to buy them bubble gum, do not repeat. Do not cave. Do not, under any circumstance, buy that bubble gum to get them to be quiet. Instead, you pick them up, you march to the car, and you go back some other time and buy your Target items when you need them or when you can. Do not be embarrassed if your child has a tantrum in the Target, but whatever you do, do not give them what they want. And do not promise it to them if they will stop crying. You cry, you don't get the bubblegum. So today, on the way to the doctor, we had a neurology appointment this morning, and my brother began tantruming. And I told him, I said, you will not get soda after the doctor's appointment today because you're screaming right now. And so he told the doctor he did not get soda because his sister was mad. I wasn't embarrassed. That's the rules. You don't get to scream and then have your way. And so the last take-home point before we stop for the evaluation is whatever planned consequence you have for the behavior, everybody on the team has to do it, and they have to do it every single time. And the consequences do not work if you don't implement them consistently over time. And so with that, I just remind you, whatever you do, if you find yourself into a difficult situation, it's much easier to put yourself in timeout than to try to put a student in timeout. So go put yourself in timeout, regroup, regain your composure, and then implement whatever consequence your team has decided should be a part of the behavior plan. All right, with that, I'll turn it over to Christy. She can do the evaluation, and then we will have time for a few questions.
Thank you. To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. Please tell us the degree to which you agree or disagree with the following statements. Number one, this session educated me on the differences between behavior deficit and behavior excess. Press star 1 if you strongly agree, star 2 if you agree, star 3 if you disagree, and star 4 if you strongly disagree. Again, that is, this session educated me on the differences between behavior deficit and behavior excess. Star 1, strongly agree, star 2, agree, star 3, disagree, and star 4, strongly disagree. We'll pause a moment to collect the responses. Question 2. This session provided me with ways to use positive behavioral supports. Star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, and star 4 for strongly disagree. Again, that is, this session provided me with ways to use positive behavioral supports. Star 1 strongly agree, star 2 agree, star 3 disagree, and star 4 strongly disagree. We'll pause again for just a moment. Question 3. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. And star 4, strongly disagree. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. And star 4, strongly disagree. We'll pause for just a moment. Question number 4. I would recommend this program to others. Press star 1 if you agree, or star 2 if you do not agree. Once again, that is, I would recommend this program to others. Star 1 if you agree, and star 2 if you do not agree. And question number 5. Please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with autism. Star 1, I am the parent of a child with autism. Star 2, I am a family member of a child with autism. Star 3, other. Once again, that is, please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with autism. Star 1, I am the parent of a child with autism. Star 2, I am a family member of a child with autism. Or star 3, other. We'll pause again for just a moment. Thank you for your feedback and for participating in our program. If you would like to make any additional comments to help us improve this program or have any questions on today's topic, please press star 1 to have your line opened into the conference. All right, and we do have a few questions in the queue. We'll take our first question. Question on your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes. If given the opportunity to have a speech-language pathologist help in the communication, considering that the communication is the base layer of the bad behavior, should we focus initially on having an SLP work with our autistic children on the communication phase first before we go towards ABA?
Well, I think that you have to do both, because the behavior person is going to really understand the problem behavior and can help the speech and language pathologist understand, you know, what communication targets should go first. But I don't think you could do one without the other. I think you do need both, and that's a fabulous question.
And we'll go to our next question. Question on your line is open. Please go ahead. If you heard a voice prompt, your line is now open. You may have yourself muted. Hearing no response, we'll move to our next question.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. I just had a quick question. I have a 7-year-old boy, and how do I know the difference between an age-appropriate behavior and an autistic behavior? And the reason I ask is that I don't know if it's his being that he just doesn't want to do something. You know, I'll ask him to do something. If he's in the middle of something and he doesn't want to break away, he doesn't want to follow any instructions or anything, he throws a tantrum. And I don't know if that's just his not wanting to do what I'm asking him or if he's just having a communication barrier, because he's starting to speak better and he understands how to talk and he knows how to talk, but I don't know if it's a communication thing or just an age thing, you know?
Right. So that kind of behavior is somewhat developmental and somewhat part of what we see with kids with autism. The difference is the age. So we don't see tantrums in 7-year-olds when they're not getting their way or when they are trying to pay attention to something else. So it is a developmentally immature behavior.
Okay.
And so I would say that is part of the autism. Kids with autism tantrum because he's not able to say, like a typical 7-year-old would say, leave me alone.
Mm-hmm.
I really want to play my Angry Birds. You're in my, you know, a typical 7-year-old would verbalize that. And I'm guessing that your 7-year-old can't. And so the tantrums are probably working for him. And so, again, working with your speech and language pathologist, like the other caller suggested, and your behaviorist to identify what are some good replacement behaviors and teaching him to say, oh, can I wait one more minute, Mommy, or hang on, or some other behavior that he can do to let you know, he needs just a little bit more before he breaks away from it.
Now, I just had one other small question. I do the if then. I love it. I cannot imagine
Great.
Life without it. He does do the PECS schedule at school, and we don't do that at home. Do you think that's something that can be incorporated together with the if-then, or is it one or the other?
No, do incorporate it together. And if
okay.
you ask your school team should be able to help you make one for home.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
And just a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. We'll go to our next question. And question on your line is now open. Hearing no response, we'll move to our next question.
Yes, I'd like to ask, when you've got your child out in public and they throw that tantrum down on the floor and they're around the shelves and they can hurt themselves and start wrecking things off the shelf, what are your type suggestions on how to handle the situation? I've got a 15-year-old daughter who sounds like she's a lot like your brother. She's severely intellectually delayed. She's autistic. She's got a chromosome defect that's an itocentric 15.
Okay.
Itocentric 15.
So my answer really comes back to the why. So we have to look at why is she doing it. Is she trying to get something on the shelf that you've told her no, she can't have? Or does she really dislike being in the store and she wants to leave?
Well, see, one of her favorite things, one of the things that she asks for is push the buggy.
Oh.
I mean, even if you pass by a grocery store and she sees the buggies, she wants a buggy.
Oh, that's what my brother does. He loves to push the buggy. It also keeps his hands where they're supposed to be.
Right. And it's just, you know, and then you can't stop her from going into the store. You know, she's bullheaded. That's where she's going.
Uh-huh.
And then once you get in there, you know, I think I've found that if I keep moving, if I know exactly something I can get and then get out, then she's fine. But if I ever stop, then that's when it happens. But
see, I'm going to go right back to the schedule. I think if you make her a visual shopping list, and then you can print it out. There's so many free pictures out there, so make a visual shopping list and teach her to mark out each item when you get it. And then I would get her favorite treat. And if she stays walking the whole time at the grocery store, then at the end she gets a special treat, whether it's chocolate or Skittles or maybe it's, you know, a $2 toy. You know, whatever she wants, she gets at the end if she doesn't fall on the floor.
And if she makes it through the checkout line.
Right. So, but again, that's where that visual schedule comes in, and you could put in a little waiting symbol at the end. So that the wait through the checkout. Now, what my brother likes to do, he does not like to wait in the line. And so instead, he takes the buggy and puts it away. And he comes back independently. And then he likes to rock. So he likes to go to the end of the checkout. And he likes to rock where all the people are walking by. And so he likes to wave at people. And so then he gets a little bit of appropriate social interaction while he's waiting, even though he hates the waiting in the line.
Okay. Well, my daughter, she's like mentally two and a half. And
same as my brother.
Okay. And she does not, she has no fear of traffic, and she'll take off running and go out the door. And, you know, she may say hi to people, but it would be that I couldn't have her, I'd have to have her right up under me.
Right. And you have to understand, my brother and I have been working on this for years. This is not something that he just learned how to do.
Right.
You know, it took a lot of practice to get there.
Okay, thank you very much. I plan to learn more information in your seminar today than I believe I ever have.
Oh, thank you.
And at this time, we have no further questions. Dr. Olive, I'll turn the conference back over to you for any additional remarks.
Okay. All right, so just a quick take-home point. One, behavior is communication. Two, the behavior needs to be assessed. Three, we want to have a good positive behavior intervention support plan to help the behavior. And finally, pick a consequence, that a way that the whole team, everybody in your child's life or the student's life, the way that they're going to respond to the behavior, so it's consistent, and the student will benefit from that. And thank you so much, Brett. I appreciate everyone asking questions and participating.
Thank you so much for attending, and thank you, Dr. Olive, for providing such wonderful insights. Again, if you have any questions about therapies discussed today, please contact the autism team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Please be sure to mark your calendars to join our next Autism Awareness Seminar on May 8th at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific, when we will be discussing augmentative communication.
And that does conclude today's conference. Again, thank you for your participation.